Hey, I'm Alan McGuire.
I'm Jack, the Pumpkin King.
And this is Juvenalia, a podcast where we talk to an interesting person about a bit of pop culture that was important to them when they were young. Our guest today is a returning guest. It's illustrator and all-around sound head, Megan Hyland. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's the most wonderful time of the year when I get to come back and talk about more skeletons that I loved when I was a child.
Yeah. Welcome back.
Yeah,
love
you're our seasonal guest. So we've done Halloween. We're back for Christmas.
We'll get to Easter eventually at some point. When
there has to be some kind of Easter skeleton. Yeah.
Yeah, there has to be. Come on, there should be. It's pagan enough.
Yeah, exactly. So you DM'd us and were like, I need to talk about this. So please tell us what you want to talk about and why.
Well, continuing on from the last time I was on here, which was the Halloween episode, this movie can be interpreted as either a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie or an any time of year movie, which is how I love to view it, which is The Nightmare Before Christmas. And the reason I love it is because if you put on any one of the songs from the film, you are instantly just like, oh, Christmas spirit, seasonal affective disorder, be gone. I am in a world of candy canes and love and sugar and all that hyper fixation stuff from when you're a kid. And Tim Burton figures into it somewhat, but more for the delightful stop motion animation and just like all around good feelings.
Sarah, you're also a fan, I believe.
The reality is that I'm going to have to sort of temper how important this film is and was to me. I watched it a lot. I feel like I saw it very late at night as a small child around Christmas once. And like on like late on kind of Channel 4 or something like that. Like an art house movie, only, you know, stop motion animation. And I was bed into it as a teenager and revisited it again, funnily enough, for a lost episode of Sentimental Garbage, the recording of which went AWOL. And watching it again, I think it was 2 years ago I watched it, and watching the documentaries about it and kind of diving back into it as an adult, like a lot of those really, and I wouldn't say all classic sort of children's films have that undertone. Like The Nightmare Before Christmas is quite fraught, and the story of it and the way that it works as watching it as an adult, especially as an adult in the arts, really is very, very different from watching it as a child. I think it's got many lives and many, it gives you something different every time you go back to it, I think. And bangers, obviously, wall to wall with that film.
Absolute bangers.
Full of tunes.
Alan, have you got a relationship with the film?
Not really. I didn't see it until I was an adult. My roommate in college was obsessed with it, though. He had a Jack Skellington tattoo on his shoulder.
Excellent.
So that's how I saw it, through him, Alan Power. Hello, Alan. And I think the first time I saw it, I had that thing that I don't know if it's unique to me, but whenever you see a musical for the first time and you're like, oh, it's a completely sung through musical pretty much, and you need to adjust to that and take it in. So really, I only watched for the second time like yesterday, and only think really properly took it in for the first time yesterday. I mean, it's great. But like I was like a fake gamer fan of Nightmare Before Christmas. I did have like a t-shirt and a Jack Skellington pen that I got at Epcot Center that I used a lot. But I mean, the aesthetic of it is bigger than the film.
Yeah.
It has been for a long time, I think.
Yeah,
completely.
Yeah.
It's wall to wall Funko Pops in there, man.
Oh, don't get me started on those.
Like that's the tricky thing about looking back on it. It's like you sort of have to reckon with your Morgoth, your inner Morgoth, and the way in which something like that was sort of a precious, strange thing that not everybody knew about, and its entry into the mainstream and its entry into sort of the grand hot topicification of all the weird little movies we liked growing up. Do you know what I mean? Which in some ways is great, but in other ways feels strange. It feels like
it's not quite yours anymore.
Yeah, like my weird private thing that I liked is, you know, and obviously it's a huge film. Like it's enormous. Like the fucking the Disney theme park fucking Halloween parties are named for it. Do you know, like there's loads of, it's not like some small art house film, it's a Disney film, but it always just felt a little bit more underground before as opposed to now when it's just Jack Skellington is effectively a Disney princess. Do you know?
Oh my god, I didn't even think about that. That I was like, yeah. Oh, weird. Okay, weird. Because like I have this, I sent you a picture of it earlier, my worn out video copy I've had since I was 6 or 7 years old.
Oh.
And like, you know, growing up in Ireland in the 90s, you had maybe 10 videos if you were lucky in your collection, unless you were like, I don't know if you're wealthy, but like we had.
Oh, out of push. You go to Extravision for the rest, you know?
Exactly. Mm. You rent. But like to physically own the film, like you adored that movie because you watched it over and over again. Like Lion King, Dalmatians, Beethoven Second, and Rescuers Down Under. Like random, like direct to video sequels, but also just like The Night Before Christmas was special because it was mine. It wasn't my sister's, it wasn't my brother's. It was my little weird fucking Halloween movie that I would watch over and over again to the point where I would watch part of it on Halloween, watch a bit of it in November, and watch part of it in December some years because I felt I needed to transition to Christmas season through this movie. Like I interpreted that kind of season from watching and enjoying all these beautiful songs and watching these puppets like stop motion animation across the screen. Like
Look beautiful, didn't it? Or it does look beautiful. Like Nate, like Henry Selick's stuff has a real touch to it, you know? And it sounds like, I think we try not on Jubilee to be like, oh, they don't make them like that anymore, but they really quite literally don't.
I don't think they could. Like that anymore. Like like you were saying earlier about rewatching the documentaries now that they start talking about the legacy of it and how it actually came to be. It was a bunch of fucking weirdos in San Francisco. Like the fact that it actually got made at all is a miracle, which makes me even love it even more that it was like this band of outsiders making something that shouldn't have existed. And then all of a sudden it's become this huge cultural icon now today.
They were all killing each other throughout. There was this sort of three-way psychic feud between Danny Elfman, Henry Selick, and Tim Burton. And because Danny Elfman was writing all the songs and voicing Jack and dating the screenwriter.
Yes. The second screenwriter, the first one was fired.
Yeah. The story of the film very accurately seems to kind of represent the tortured male artist story that is seemingly quite accurate to what Selick and very specifically Elfman were going through during production. So the story of the film being made becomes the story of the film itself, if that makes sense. It's the way, like the Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask is about the moon falling and time running out because those guys only had a year to make that game. So it's like a direct artistic expression of the conflict of making stuff is all the Night Before Christmas is, you know?
Like watching it now as an adult, the thing that literally I wrote down in my notes when I was rewatching it was Jack is creative burnout and he's finding a new hobby and he's trying to make it fit and be like, this is who I am now. And everyone's like, oh, so you're going to like do that thing that you're always doing. He's like, no, I'm tired of that thing. That's past. I'm beyond that. I'm not doing that anymore. But we love you when you do this thing. No, I'm doing this whole new thing. Okay, but you're really good at doing this thing. Do you think you're ever going to come back to it? And then by the end, he's realizing, actually, I'm really good at that thing and I enjoy that thing. And I should just give myself over and my burnout's over. I've had a holiday. I'm back to who I am and I'm revitalized.
Play the old stuff.
It's about creative burnout. Like it's watching like Kiki's Delivery Service. It is that thing of like,
I think it's a masculine counterpart to Kiki's Delivery Service. Kiki's Delivery Service is feminine burnout and finding a feminine mentor who will slow you down and restore you. Whereas I think Jack's virtuoso kind of vibe is a much more, to speak in blunt binaries, it's a much more art dude thing, you know? Everyone around him is enabling him rather than being, except Sally, of course, instead of being like, maybe you should not do this thing, you should go asleep for a while and go to the river and think about your feelings. They're like, oh, cool, Jack's just gone to usurp another culture and steal a bunch of its shit and kidnap its leader.
Yeah, quite cultural appropriation-y, isn't it? Like the whole theme of the film.
Yeah.
I couldn't find like a, I was trying to like think about it last night. I couldn't find like a non-cynical message out of the film. It was like, stick to what you're good at. Don't like try break out of your box.
Be true to yourself.
Everybody hates a tourist, like common people.
Everybody hates a tourist.
That is very true.
Yeah, for sure.
Just because you wear the t-shirt and you think you know the songs doesn't mean you're really into this band, that kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Well, like, no, that's a terrible way of putting it. It's like you're putting on a mask. You're not actually understanding what the true meaning of it is. And like, it is really about him learning what the true meaning of Christmas is. For like, the kid's interpretation is like, oh, Jack learns the true meaning of Christmas. Like, he shouldn't have stolen it. He just should have embraced it and learned it and loved it. And maybe just talked to Santa Claus at the beginning and be like, hey, what is up with your town? It's really cool, but like, what's the deal with it? Maybe that would have solved a lot of problems. But no, he had to be a weird stalker around Christmas town and then go home and be like, I have an understanding of this thing and I want it and I want it all.
I think what's nice is that he can't unsee through his like lens either, which is nice that he's like, what is this powder coming out of the sky? Why are there children everywhere? What is happening here? And even the way he perceives Santa Claus or Sandy Claus as this kind of monster, he can't unsee the world through his own, other than through his own view, which I think is a lot of fun. I mean, like, as a non-Christmas enjoyer, famously non-Christmas enjoyer, I think looking at it as a film about art rather than a film about holidays is the kind of a nicer approach, do you know? And is Jack a bad guy? Is he a baddie? Or is he just sort of a tortured soul? Like, I don't know. It's an interesting arc.
He's misunderstood. I feel like he's definitely, like, because Danny Elfman was, like, if you watch the movies that made us, like, it makes it like paints it very clear that Danny was writing these songs and very much about him being burnt out with his band and like the being a live musician and going around and the audience screaming at you night after night and you just not finding any enjoyment out of it anymore. Like, it's like, it is, you hear it, but it's so relatable. I think like it is that thing of like, it's in it, the best kind of kids movies has something for the grown-ups as well as the kids. And I think when you go back to it now and you see that as like, oh, I completely like empathize with Jack, whereas before it was like, oh my god, I love it, all these cool funny characters are so spooky and fun when you're a kid, but like there's multiple layers.
And poor old Sally, I feel like the sort of the journey that so many of us go on is going from being somebody else's Sally cheering on their journey to becoming a Jack, you know. I think she sort of gets the short end of the stick, obviously, for throughout. Even though she's sort of in charge of her own escape, and she's, you know, her escape is also visually brilliant, like the way that she undoes herself and gets out of that lab and the bottle and with frog's breath, like you can, it's so textured and it's so delightful, all the stuff that she goes through, like unpicking her whole body and throwing herself at the, it's so fabulous to look at. But the poor bitch, like, she's sort of defined by her
male relationships.
Yeah, and by being kind of this sort of Cassandra at the fucking gates of Troy, being like, please don't do this. This is a bad idea. And Jack being like, silence, I'm a genius, you know. So hers is sort of a tragic arc. Even if they do get together in the end, and it's all very sweet and that incredible. Like, I remember the first time, or one of the first times that the hill unfolding itself and the two of them on top of the hill and stuff, that really, like, that kind of lives in me a bit, you know? But I also feel for her as the, you know, girlfriend to a tortured artist. That sucks, you know?
So, like, you can really see that, like, Catherine Thompson, who was the second screenwriter who came on after the first guy was fired, for apparently kind of finding a lot of powdered snow somewhere and just having a lot of fun with it. She really like brought herself to that character because she was at the time the girlfriend of Danny Elfman. So you can kind of see that like this needs a more like a female touch to this character. She needs to be fleshed out more. She's not a femme fatale. She is a crafty girl in every way. She like would be a cottagecore girl, like making her own soups, like tending to her own little garden. She just wants to have her own little life and do her bits and sew her little costumes. Like, she's such a great character, and it's great that to have that female counterpart in the story, and just also to have Catherine O'Hara be the voice, which the mother from Home Alone, like, and from Beetlejuice as well, obviously. But like, I love that she has like two of the most iconic Christmas movies under her belt, and she's Moira Rose.
Yeah, she's fabulous. Like, she's just somebody who every time I see her, I'm happy to see her. Though, on a small research quest I was doing recently, I did discover that in Home Alone, she was 36.
Oh,
That feels bad. Feels bad. Do you want to say it feels bad?
Yeah, we have, like,
birthdays in January. Feels bad.
Yeah. In our house, Barry is stew pickles. Like, we're at that age now, and you realize all your friends are just like this babies everywhere, and weddings, and you're like, oh, lovely. We're the parents' age in every kids' show ever, because people used to get married in their early 20s and not now, where we're all like, well, into our adulthood, still being grown up children, enjoying animation movies.
I think that that sort of little bit that they often clip out of the Rugrats is Stew Pickles standing in the kitchen, like, making himself chocolate pudding over the sink or at like 3 o'clock in the morning, is the most late 30s thing, parent or not. You know, they were always speaking. They were always speaking back to us, or our folks at the time. And going back to it, you didn't really have much relationship with it. What did you think of it? Because you know, yesterday, even when you watched it, like, for the sort of second time or whatever, like, how did you find that it resonated with you?
So I really enjoyed it. First of all, like, it's not controversial to say it's a great fucking film. It really, the songs are all amazing. Like, I knew the songs, like, inside out, most of them anyway. Like I said, I was trying, because I knew it was a bit to talk about, I was trying to, like, figure out what the point of it was, and I couldn't find a positive lesson from it, really. You know, like I said, like, it's like Stick to Your Lane was kind of the closest to a true line I could find, and I was like, that's a weird message for a children's film, which because you said to be some kind of, like, you can do whatever you want, everything is, the world's your oyster, but this is like, no, you're the Halloween guy and you're gonna fuck it up if you do anything besides the Halloween thing, so stick to being the Halloween guy and enjoy that and appreciate it. I don't know if that's like a bit of Tim Burton, like, having done Beetlejuice and then Batman, and like being like, am I the spooky guy? Because that's kind of what Tim Burton has done.
Well, this film was only based on his illustrations. Like, he was this, so the part of the legacy of this film is that, like, it's Henry Selick's film. And it's just based on a set of drawings that Burton did, and sort of Jack had this idea for Jack and was like, there you go. And there was this, and I believe there still is huge contention about the presence of Tim Burton's name on the title, which is Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, when
it was Henry Selick all along.
Henry Selick. You know, like a thankless work.
It was a poem Tim Burton had written in 1984, back when he was at Disney with Henry Selick, which is where they first met.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then the same year he got fired and went away and became Tim Burton. And like you said, he made Pee-wee's Big Adventure with Paul Rubens. And then it was that was his first directing job.
Paul Rubens is in Nightmare Before Christmas as well, isn't he?
Yeah, he plays one of the little trick-or-treater characters.
He's Locker, Shock, and Barrel.
Yeah, which I used to think was like Jacques, like the French pronunciation, and Barrel. I'm like, are these like gothic writers? I don't know. I'm like, no, it's like lock and key, Shock as in like bolt of lightning shock, and then Barrel as in a barrel of whiskey. I was like, oh right, or it's like a shotgun. But I digress. They meet in Disney, they get fired, they go away, make Pee-wee, he gets really big, he makes Batman, and then he's like, oh, but Disney still own the rights to his character, and he's like, can I buy that back off you, because the mouse owns your soul while you work for them, and anything you create for them is theirs. She says, having signed a contract with them at one time that gave them use of their artwork in perpetuity across the universe, including methods that have yet to be invented, which is an actual line in the contract. But he went to buy the rights back and they're like, you're a big deal now, so why don't we make it together? And then they started making it, but he's like, oh, I'm making Batman Returns at the moment, so I can't, but I will put Henry Selick in charge and he can go do it. And apparently he came to set five times over two years.
2 years.
So the ultimate creative director.
Like, that's a lot of time to be killing your fucking co-workers, you know what I mean? Like, that's a lot of time for a bunch of people to be like not getting on with each other and making an animated movie, you know?
Yeah. But like, the fact that like he became such a cultural icon that it had to be Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas to sell the thing, to show that, like, oh, teenagers, goths, come watch it, it's a Tim Burton thing.
It's wild. It's really, really wild. And like, the other kind of the notes of Tim Burton were something I was kind of obsessed with as a teenager as well, like his children's picture books and stuff like that, which again there's so many of those kinds of, it's called, it's like The Melancholy Death of Oyster Boy and Other Stories, like, was a book that we had.
I have a copy of it.
It was such a coveted object.
Classic HMV front counter.
Yeah, but like,
object. Yeah.
It felt like, but getting that when we were sort of 14 or whatever age, you know, that is, again, 20 years ago. That felt like a really special object, but now it feels like the world is sort of full of those sort of things. And it's a really stark difference for me in how tricky it was to be a goth and how you sort of had to seek out your totems and talismans in a way that felt meaningful, rather than just, it's much easier now to be able to express yourself or to be able to try it on for size. Whereas before, it was something you sort of just had to figure out. Like, we only had one copy between us, me and my pal Helena, of this Tim Burton book. We fucking like loved it, you know? And like, it's fine. Do you know what I mean? It's not even really that good. It's just, it was just something that had our favorite director's name written on it, which was enough to feel like a connection to the other side, you know? Like, she went on to become an animator as well. Like, she did animation because of it. She's not a full-time animator now, but that was her field of study. Like, she's a designer, but the animation was, I think, because of that stuff, you know, because of Selleck and because of Burton and that kind of thing. So like, it really did a very profound impact, I think, on the lives of baby goths across the world. And it's funny because Burton has become such a sort of a parody of himself now. Like, how special things like The Nightmare Before Christmas and Beetlejuice and stuff felt. It feels cheapened or something now, if that makes sense. That's not very kind, but do you know what I mean?
It feels like it's in the 3 for 2 section now, whereas before it was such a little, you had to like go take the train to, like I did when I was a teenager, take the train from Kildare to Dublin, take the Lewis over to Stephen's Green, go to the top floor to Asha when it was one of the only goth places in town.
Yes.
And like, seek out those little bits and bobs and like find your tribe and who enjoy them as well, and just talk about the kind of like, oh my god, isn't it such a cool little book? Like,
it doesn't go to say like we're gate, like this isn't keeping the gates. I'm very glad that more people are able to access them and more people are able to, like, do you know what I mean? It's not like these kids think that, it's not like that. It's more like, god, we really loved it so much and we really put so much effort into gathering these things and to sort of building these altars and figuring out as much about Tim Burton as we could. But in saying that, I also didn't know it all by any stretch of the imagination. And going back and watching that documentary about the making of Nightmare Before Christmas was a fucking shocker. You know, I was like, god, this is rancid vibes. You know, everyone here is fucking fuming. Like, they've all got a bone to pick with each other. They're all snapping. So it's so odd to think that something that's so treasured as Nightmare Before Christmas has such horrendous vibes. Do you know? Like, there's such, like,
I kind of love that. It's the kind of like the swan on the surface versus the paddling underneath.
Underneath, yeah, yeah.
Because like, you, if you've ever worked in any kind of like group setting in a creative atmosphere, you understand at some point the fucking nerves. Like, you get on someone's last nerve or someone does something and you make a decision, they change it back, and it's just like, which is my life a lot of the time when I work in like creative atmospheres. It's just very much like you can see that like personalities clash, because creative people, they are very passionate about their point of view, and they feel like a lot of the time, like if you are in a creative field, you have a talent for it, and like that has been nurtured somewhat, so you do feel like you have like I know what I'm doing, I know, like people have told me that I'm doing the right thing, I know what I'm doing. So then to be in the bigger pond and like have other creatives correct you or tell you you're wrong, it can be very sensitive. And you can see, especially when there's like $8 million budget, and then all of a sudden, who's responsible for what? We need to get this done. Nobody's getting work done. The script isn't finished. We need to get this movie underway or else it's gonna be gone. And everyone's at each other's throats. And I'm just like, it's every creative project ever, which is also fun because like, it, I know this is about like, like we were talking about the really like grown up reading of it, which is like Jack creative burnout, but it is that thing of like, he's also pulling off a group project with a huge team of characters and trying to get them all on board and like be the boss of this place as well and try and get it done and done right.
The thing about having an unfinished script is one thing when you're working with real life people, but it's another thing when you're doing stop motion, which is agonizing because of how many like 40 frames a second or whatever it is, how many different like micro movements you have to put into a horrible little skeleton's mouth if you want to change a song. I will say, though, this is, I'm coming in harsh, as much as I love all the tunes, which I do, I can sing the film backwards and forwards. Like, I can, like, it is just, it's in there where the rest of my memory should be. Like, there's not a song that I don't know in that film, the completely verbatim. That and Cats, weirdly, just all of it. And Joseph and his Second Color Dreamcoat. It's just what's stored up in there. In saying that, many of the lyrics are bad. Like, many of them simply do not make sense or rhyme. Like, that is very real. Like,
what's your favorite example?
Let me get this. I feel like Kidnap the Sandy Claws is hanging together on quarter rhymes. It does not function. Sure. It does not function. I'm going to give you an example then. Hang on. Lyrics. Kidnap the Sandy Claws. I've got this here. I'll make sure I get this in sequence. Okay. Wait, I've got a better plan to catch this big red lobster man. Let's pop him in a boiling pot, and when he's done, we'll butter him up. That doesn't make any, that is completely out of context, that it does not make any sense whatsoever. And when he's done, we'll butter him up. That the rhythm that sits in the song is so odd. because later on, he's like, what does he say? Oh yeah, Jack beating us black and green, only black and green because it rhymes with smithereens. That is not a thing anybody has ever said. You're so stupid, comma, think now. If we blow him up to smithereens, we may lose some pieces, and then Jack will beat us back and cream, back and black and green. That is rhythmically fine, but the "you're so stupid," comma, think now. If we blow him up to smithereens, that does not sound. That is not lyrical. That is a bunch of fucking words. Like, there's loads of instances of wonky rhythm, and just give it a second pass. Do you know? Like, give it a second pass there. Like, that doesn't sound right, buddy. But I would imagine he was not tellable. There's lots of this whole song, the Kidnapped Sandy Claws, is a bum tune in an otherwise very strong soundtrack. But every song has a couple of fucking weird lines that don't really work quite right. But again, a little bit of that is the product of the time, that like it was allowed to be a bit out of sync. It was allowed to be a bit wonky and a bit wrong because people trusted these guys to just kind of do what they wanted. So even if they were doing it in a way that was kind of fucked up and kind of wrong, they were like, it's fine, Sandy Elfman, he knows what he's doing. You know,
it's very much like you're okay to have wonky lines because it's all part of the aesthetic. So wonky lyrics, wonky lines, weird. It's a weird ass movie made by weird ass people, so add more weirdness to it. But like, by God, the songs are catchy. Like, you kind of overlook the lyrics.
The lyrics are brilliant. The melodies are brilliant. Like, they're proper fantastic, you know?
My favorite lyric from the opening song, This Is Halloween. This is why I rang you guys up. I literally, for the crack, just cycling home with the headphones in, I popped that on because it was Halloween. And it was like the day before Halloween, and that was just like, you just get into the rhythm of it and you're like, oh my God, it's such a good tune. But it's that thing of like, all the characters are talking about their jobs that they have to do on Halloween and how they're so spooky and scary. But like, there's like this lovely one where it's like two kids and two parent monsters, and they're like talking about they're scaring, and then you're like, that's our job, but we're not mean. And it's just very much like, oh, okay. See, like, it's such a lovely touch that, like, it's such a scary movie that, like, nobody thought was supposed to be for kids. Like, all the executives were like, is this for children? I don't know if it is. It's a bit too scary. And it's like, no, of course it's for kids. But they're not mean. They're just doing their job. They're just spooky. And, like, they embrace it. They're goth. What of it?
That's true. It's a good celebration. Job. It's not,
you know,
yeah.
It's their job to be scary. It's not necessarily, well, it is kind of there.
There's no malice. They're just doing it because it's fun. They're doing it because it's in their nature.
And, you know, in saying that about bad lyrics, there are a couple of very beautiful ones in This Is Halloween. I am the who when you call who's there. I am the wind going through your hair. That's gorgeous. Danny, you're able to do it. You know, you're able to do it. You're able to do I am the pentameter. Can we just fucking consistency, please?
Funny bit of trivia, just because you brought up Cats as the other kind of musical that you know word for word. The guy who plays Oogie Boogie used to play Old Deuteronomy on the original Broadway production of Cats.
Sick. Old Deuteronomy is two roles that I could play in Cats due to my inability to dance. One of them is Old Deuteronomy and the other is Grisabella. Both of them walk on and walk the fuck off. That is exactly what I could play in Cats. You simply would not catch me jumping through the air like Magical Mr. Mistopheles or any of the other little pricks. I would be walking on in my big coat and walking the fuck off. Those are good roles.
So you're not going to be Sally Bowles anytime soon.
You know, Oogie Boogie's the fucking business, man. Terrifying, absolute visceral memories of seeing the fucking the stitches maggots unfolding on the maggots coming out of the bag. Again, film enjoys stitches a lot, and I can only imagine that animating those was a fucking nightmare. But his body coming apart. Also, why the fuck is that a casino? Does it make any sense? No logic. No logic at all. That song is a banger. Now, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense?
No. I questioned why it was a casino. I'm like, because a gambling is a grown-up thing that kids aren't allowed to enjoy. So maybe it's like, this is like an adult world that you're not supposed to be a part of.
And in some ways, it just looks cool is a good enough reason.
Mm-hmm. UV light. You
know? Yeah, UV. Like, there's the roulette wheel looks cool.
I think, like, probably because the lyric, I'm a gambling man, and then all of a sudden the art director is like, boom, casino.
Like, I'll let them away. Like, it feels like,
yeah, it feels like maybe like Henry Selick or Tim Burton or one of the many other people like had something against gambling that they assumed everybody else knew about and it was a very common thing and it actually wasn't, that they had an association with gambling and Halloween, and like everybody associates gambling with Halloween, right? And people were like, sure,
maybe it's a superstition.
Okay, Henry.
Maybe it's because like gamblers are superstitious. They like Lady Luck. Luck or something like that, like that is that thing of like there's a bit of like a spirit of something in the air that like it's a kind of like a spirit. Maybe Oogie Boogie is like the bad omen spirit when you're like gambling. Oh, I have no idea.
I'm sure somewhere in some long forgotten notebook there is a clear explanation of exactly why there is an unprompted casino montage, however that is left to mystery sometimes. And I think I have to settle on this with my little weird quibbles with Danny Elfman-Phoney and lyrics and little weird things that are kind of incongruous, is sometimes you just do it for the vibes, man. This is somebody's vision. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, it's important that things are weird and kind of wrong. This is my sci-fi argument again. I should sometimes be able to see the lines in the set, you know. Like, I really don't need this to be perfect. I need it to be what it is. And even the bits that snag on me, I feel fondly about, you know. It's such a fucking, it's such a singular work, you know.
I think that goes back to the monsters. Like, besides the vampires, none of them are standard like Halloween monsters. It's all brand new monsters.
Yeah.
And I think if it had originated as a fully Disney thing, you would have a mummy, and I guess there's witches, but like they're weird witches. They're angular, squashed kind of witches. But you don't have like mummies and werewolves and all that kind of stuff.
You do.
You have a little, you have your Greek chorus of, there's a werewolf. I'm completely
364.
I am full of shit about this.
I miss him. And there's like the sea monsters are really good as well. But they're not, because of the way they're designed, they don't look like your archetypes either. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Thank you for saving me. Yes.
They just have general. Like, they did, but there is a lot of just like the mayor is fucking terrifying with his horrible little switched face that kind of turns around on its head. He's like a toy in himself. Like, he's fucking
two-faced politician,
and Dr. fucking Finkelstein with his disgusting brain that he scratches and you can almost feel the texture. Like, he's both Frankenstein's monster and Frankenstein, if you were to look at it in that way. He combines the two. And he just wants a sexy wife. Like, he's out here building himself a sexy wife the second Sally's out the window. Like, he's a man with a plan. He's busy. He's also gross and creepy. Like, Oogie Boogie, gross and creepy. Fucking Dr. Finkelstein, gross and creepy. Like, those are, like, in the same way that Spirited Away is, like, has sort of a kind of an undertone to it.
This has,
like, a creepy, like, kind of sexy undertone to it as well. Which is why you could never make a sequel or ever remake it. It simply would be sanitized. Like, there is a kind of a texture and a grit and aesthetically what we associate with creepy bullshit is all over it, right? You know, black and white stripes, fucking skeletons, whatever. But there is a kind of a...
There's a weird sexy vibe going through it at times.
Why is this a sexy film? Like, why? What is... Explain this to me. Because I think this is the unifier of loads of people who grew up with it, where you're like, why am I kind of bet into this? Like, yeah. Why am I discovering things? What is happening to me? Like, I don't...
Why really... am I kind of into a skeleton? Like, I don't understand.
He doesn't quite have the fucking Robin Hood thing going for him, you know? But no. There's something... It might be Danny Elfman's voice. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what the vibe is with this film, man. It's got a texture. It's hard to describe.
Like, Burton, like, when you look at Edward Scissorhands and you look at Beetlejuice, they're, like, I know, like, Tim Burton, he, like, it's his, like, he inspired by his drawings, but, like,
but they're
his
all
movies
about women who want to fuck weird guys. Like, they're all what? Movies about women who want
to
fuck weird guys.
It's literally just Tim Burton wants to have a sexy woman. Like, that's the ethos.
Edward Scissorhands is a sad, weird guy. Beetlejuice is a gross, weird guy. Like, he just loves making stories about weird guys.
Sweeney Todd, yeah.
Weird guy, you know.
Sleepy Hollow, kind of.
Weird guy.
Weird guy. Alice in Wonderland, not a weird guy.
Batman's a fucking weird guy.
Batman's a weird guy.
Mm. The last time Batman was allowed to be a weird guy was on Tim Burton's watch. I don't fucking observe any Batman posts. Fucking Burton Batman. Like, no way.
He just loves making creepy Christmas films because, like, Batman Returns, Christmas film. Oh, and yeah. Edward Scissorhands, Christmas film.
Yeah, yeah. Have we done Edward Scissorhands in this podcast, though?
We haven't, no.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's good.
Something for next Christmas or Halloween.
Yeah, it's good. Holds up. Actually, am I lying? Does it hold up? I think it holds up. I think it's actually...
I think it does. Yeah, yeah.
It does when you think about, like, back to the bit where we were talking about the wonkiness of this world, the wonky lines. One of the director's notes he gave was Halloween Town is not allowed to have any right angles. No right angles.
Yes.
You have weird lines, German expressionism inspired Dr. Caligari's closet, like weird spirals and stripes everywhere. And then when you get to the real world, which is like reminiscent of Burbank, California, where he grew up, much like in Edward Scissorhands, it's modular bungalows, grid, straight lines, very, very boring. And I love that kind of like very much. This is a completely different world. It's its own weird thing. And this is the boring, bland, normal world. We are having way more fun in the weird angle place.
I think the chances are that Burton stopped being able to make those kind of films when he sort of ascended.
Yeah.
You know, like, not really going to buy him as sort of a weird outsider anymore. You know what I mean? Like, at his big age, at this point in his life, like, you're not going to convince me, dude, do you know? Whereas maybe when he was starting out, his case for the I am a weird and tortured soul in a landscape of homogenous normies, that was kind of easier to digest. Whereas now it's like, Timothy. Alice in Wonderland, really? Really? You know, he's...
Willy Wonka.
Oh, I simply do not observe, man. People are out here telling that... No, too many chocolate factories, guys. We're inundated with inexplicable retellings of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Like
the worst part of that remake is tangentially related to Christmas, because when they adapted Terry Pratchett's Hogfather for Sky One, the guy playing the villain in that decided to copy Johnny Depp's
Wonka
for his like posh assassin and completely. Forever ruined it. It makes me so angry thinking about it. And that's directly Johnny Depp and Tim Burton's fault that a Terry Pratchett thing got ruined, which makes me very personally upset.
I mean, Gene Wilder did such a perfect job the first time. Yeah. It's just, it was an impossible task to do anything that could have surpassed it. Like, Timothy Chalamet is probably trying to now in his new version, but like, I liked Tim Burton movies. And like it's just when he's trying to adapt other people's work is when he goes wrong. Yeah. When he's doing his own weird shit, it's perfect.
Like, I couldn't tolerate Wednesday, obviously, because I'm like old. I'm old. This shit isn't for me anymore. This is the other thing. You have to know when enough to know. You know? Like, there are few enough directors in this world that I'm like, I will walk after you into hell, David Lynch. I will walk after you into hell, Britt Marling. Anything you fucking do, I will watch it, no problem. But at a certain point, like, Namor am I still a fucking Morgoth of any shape or form, but it still does live in me. And I still have to be like, I've such, like yourself, I've such fond and serious memories of revisiting this film, of it mattering to me, of it somehow being a part of the constellation of things that made up my personality. Because for so many of us during our teenagers, the things that you liked were you, right? It was how you quantified worth within another, is what bands do you like, what movies do you like. So
cultural
it was a way
currency.
Right, exactly. It was a way of finding your people and also a way of codifying your experience and separating yourself from people, right? And it was special and it remains special. And again, on the rewatch, even more special in some ways, because it's like, oh shit, this is a film of being a tired artist. Who could have predicted that I would have ended up that way? But with Burton, at a certain point, I sort of just had to be like, we're finished. Thank you for the memories. I do not know what the fuck you were doing. I am sad that it ended like this, because there was a certain point at which I would have followed him anywhere, but I am so good for whatever it is he is doing now. However, I have high hopes for the Morgoths of the future and of the present, who are discovering him for the first time via things like Wednesday, do you know? And get to voyage back into the past in a way that is much easier than us having to drag our arses into fucking HMV or Tower Records and look for a copy of Ed Wood. You know, they have a much easier access point, so they're coming in from a different vantage point and will travel back. So maybe the first time they encounter Jack Skellington is on a t-shirt or as a Funko Pop or whatever, but what is waiting for them still has the same potential for importance and escapism and laughs and all that good shit that Nightmare Before Christmas gave to us when we found it in respectively video shops or on late night ITV or Channel 4. Do you know what I mean?
Completely. I think that's important to think about today. Like, it is that thing, like, I know we were talking about, like, we're not gatekeeping this, but it was because it was few and far between, we held them so dearly. And it you're kind of just almost like, oh, I can't wait for you to watch that for the first time. I wish I could rewatch it for the first time. It is that thing.
Could you imagine getting to see it again for the first time? I think it would see, that's what I'm curious to see about how you felt about it all. Because even though it's sort of, again, there's no clear fucking message, I would love to revisit it, do you know? And that's why I know it inside out. So I haven't watched it since I watched it for Sentimental Garbage 2 years ago, but I know it. Do you know what I mean? Like, something's up with Jack, something's up with Jack. Like, I can hear the whole thing in my fucking head. And I think the longer I give it between watches, it gains back a little of that power that it used to have, because I know it so intimately. Do you know? Because you forget all the little extraneous details, you know?
Yeah, I'd forgotten pretty much the entire second half of the film from the first time I watched it. So that was all a surprise. I'd forgotten how hard it goes. I'd forgotten it goes into the real world.
Like, yeah.
That's
they're out here fucking, they're out here putting snakes under Christmas trees and shit. Like, they're out here damaging children.
But also, Jack's getting shot down by the military. And he's
shot out of the sky.
Yeah, and like lying half dead across an angel in a graveyard, which is like
stunning.
Very
love
extremely
that he falls in a graveyard.
Hard goth imagery. Yeah.
Incredible reprise in that moment as well. You know, like just a brilliant defeat. Like,
I love the reprise in that song where he's just realizing, you know what? I gave it a shot. It was fun. And I've been really inspired on how to scare people more because I tried to do something different. But it's just the way Danny sings that song is just so fucking good.
Mournful. Yeah. Like, you can really, for all of our like, and they all fucking hated each other, lol, it's actually very expressive. Like, you can really feel the frustration, like, you know. And the same in Dolly's song, which is again, like, I feel like I saw fucking they did like the anniversary, they do like a concert, and fucking like Billie Eilish is out here singing it beautifully, like doing such a stunning job of it, you know. And
Bridges did it as well, like, oh
Jesus,
my god,
yeah. Like, it's great to see it brought out again and again, because it's got, it's such a perfect little ballad, like it's immaculate. But also, when it's being sung, you could really feel that the lyrics are about something very prescient, do you know? It's fucking cool. It's a cool film.
I kind of love that it has this legacy now, that like it was this weird little film and now it's literally like in gigantic celebrity concerts where they reunite the cast and people go just to hear the music. Like the yeah. It sold out the Three Arena when they had the actual actors come and sing the songs from the movie.
Oh like, my God, I would have loved to have seen that.
What other kids movie actually does that? Like, I know that it was supposed to be Disney. They didn't even release it on Disney because they thought it was too scary. So it went out through Touchstone Pictures. And then it wasn't until...
I can see the little Touchstone logo. Yeah.
Which they used to make bangers. That don't exist anymore, I don't think. I haven't seen that intro in a while. But the fact that, like, it was this thing, they went to video and had a whole life on video for the people who found it. And then... DVD re-release 2000, that's when Disney were like, oh, this is a cash cow, let's put our name back on it, let's put Tim's name and put out there everywhere. And it's that thing of like,
let's fit Epcot Center with it.
Yeah, but like let's make a fucking theme park ride, let's have a musical, let's like re-release everything on Mondo. But it's that thing that's a huge legacy that like I don't know of any other kids movie that, apart from maybe like The Lion King or Frozen, that has that kind of huge cultural legacy that like started from such meager beginnings.
That was it. Well, I don't think it was intended to be a fucking banger.
No.
Like its cult has grown exponentially and kind of continues to grow, you know. Just kind of great. Like I was about to say, that means it's fucking hope for us all, but I don't think those things happen really anymore. I don't think you get movies like this. Like, it's too weird.
I don't think there's like, you can't really carry your fandom for like Paw Patrol into your teens legitimately.
Oh,
you
no.
know, the way you can with Nightmare Before Christmas or even like Lion King or any of those. Whereas Nightmare Before Christmas, because it's so specific and it's so weird and stays weird, it doesn't become like more understandable as you go into your teenage years and become adult. It's still a fucking weird film.
Still fucking oblique.
Weird shit.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of stuff for you to diffuse that interest into other things because it's so single-minded and such a unique object. I guess there's Corpse Bride now, which I haven't seen. You're not like there's not a lot of jumping off points into other stuff from Nightmare Before Christmas the way there is where you just, if you enter Lincoln, you go into all of Disney.
Hmm.
You're not like Nightmare Before kids don't become Disney adults necessarily.
Yeah. This is what I mean about being kind of singular, you know. It is again like it's Morgoth, right? You become a fucking Morgoth is what you become.
Exactly, yeah.
But like, I don't know, man. It kind of...
I feel like it's a Tim Burton to David Lynch kind of through line for that kind of adult.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like the fucking real ones end up watching Twin Peaks in the end. Do you know what I mean? So maybe there is sort of a school for Morgoths for which this is kind of a foundational text. And I'm very proud to have attended and graduated that school. You know, like it's something that I look back on as like everyone, you know, you're all kind of embarrassed. Well, everyone's embarrassed as their teenagers to a certain extent, but I also feel very fondly about that kid who was very committed to this film and very committed to, but I also don't think I understood why. I don't actually think I understood what the film was about at all. Not even fucking nearly in the way that I can now. I thought it was just great tunes, spooky monsters, weird vibes that I can't put my finger on. And also, are you okay, Alan?
Something just occurred to me. I'm like, Eraserhead has, like, the Eraserhead baby could slip into Nightmare Before Christmas, no problem. It has a banger song, it has weird sex vibes. It's largely black and white.
You're right.
And it's very similar.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Is the banger song the fucking Radiator song, Alan?
Yes, it is.
In heaven. Oh my God. You're not fucking wrong.
The weird fucking cheeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Weird. Like that sort of recipe is, yeah, maybe like, maybe it's a type of film. Like it's a type of film, but you don't know what type of film it is. And when you're watching it for the first time as a teenager with no media literacy or frontal lobe, you don't know, but you're collecting pieces of your fucking taste. That's what it is. You don't know what your taste is going to be. But I think my taste is the way it is because of that.
If your taste is a jigsaw, Nightmare Before Christmas is a corner piece.
Oh, hugely,
like,
yeah.
Once you find it, like you're like, oh, yeah, okay.
And like, I think now because of the internet and the way that we all communicate about the things that we love through expressions of fandom, right? This is sort of just something you see a lot. Like, there are so many more Howl's Moving Castle's girlies than I ever could have anticipated loving it as a teenager. Do you know what I mean? And again, with Nightmare Before Christmas becoming ubiquitous. You could never have anticipated that either. Like, there's, but just because it belongs to everyone else doesn't mean that it doesn't
also belong to you
in a very singular and particular way that I still can't explain, you know. Like, I'm glad that I didn't get it, because like I grew into getting it. It's cool to visit something again and go, oh wow, look what this has to show me still all this time later, and I was too fucking thick to know. So I'm excited about what it shows me again in the future.
One of my favorite experiences with the movie in recent years was getting to show it to my young nephew for the first time.
Oh,
he is my little buddy. He is my pal. I try to push my cultural touchstones onto him, because I'm like, I want to be that kind of cool auntie for you to show you and introduce you to things. And I brought him on a day trip to Dublin for his kind of Christmas treat. Like, we're going to go to movies and we're going to go and get food after. I'm going to share this thing with you because I think you'll enjoy it. And it was like an 11 a.m. screening in the Lighthouse. I love the Lighthouse because they show it every year.
All Lighthouse stands in this podcast. Fucking love the Lighthouse.
Love the Lighthouse so much. I live there. There was like three people in the audience, but it was me and him. And it was kind of like almost like our own personal screening of it.
Yeah.
And he was watching it for the first time and he loved it. And he's gotten into stop motion. He's hasn't stopped drawing, which I just love to nurture that kind of artistic side of him, but also just to see that like this isn't like your mum, or you know, when like, because like RTE was the only thing back in the day. You would see movies from the 80s or whatever, and like you're like, oh, that's old, I'm not gonna watch that. But like, I'm so glad that it's such a, that Nightmare is such a movie that like you can pass timeless. It on to the next generation.
It's timeless.
It doesn't feel like it's age. It just feels like a weird, cool movie that everyone can enjoy and everyone can take something from. And I love sharing that with other people.
That's gorgeous. So if I get handed it on like a weird torch,
my little talisman, I'm like, here you go. You shall be a goth.
That's cool.
Probably won't.
Maybe that's the next iteration of it. Do you know what I mean? Like the different times at which you visit the kind of the important text. That's cool as hell.
Yeah, that seems like a perfect place to leave it, I think. Meg, please plug anything you want to plug. Where can people find you?
They can find me on Instagram, still hanging on, mostly on stories these days. I have ideas bubbling, they're just not on the surface right now. At Meg Highland, I'm on the Bold app still just for observation, and I'm on Blue Sky at Meg Highland now, mostly for the Irish Twitter heads who I followed have moved over there. But you can also find me in my house enjoying the Christmas vibes this time of year.
Sarah, where can we find you?
I don't live in the fucking mountains anymore, Alan. That's where you can find me, not there. I now, in the spirit of fucking Tim Burton, live beside a fucking graveyard, fulfilling my destiny. I'm not on the Bird app anymore. Finally pulled the plug. I am on the clock one. I'm on TikTok, posting videos of my cat sometimes, at Sarah Grifsky, on Instagram, at Sarah Grifsky also. I've been saying for over a year that I've news, and I'm going to say it again. Can't tell you yet. The news that was signed into reality over a year ago is still a reality, but it is still not being announced at this time. It will be in the new year. But you can find my other books, Other Rivers of Rogue and Spare and Pen Pirates in all good bookstores. I think that's it. Alan, what about you?
Also, not on the Bird site anymore. I am on Blue Sky. Alan McGuire? I think
Alan McGuire. Yeah,
I said this every time. I'm pretty sure I should check what my actual name is on there. Juvenalia is also there. It's Juvenalia. We got Juvenalia there. I need to really zone in on all these new social media things and know what they are.
I know.
We have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/juvenalia, where we talk about what we started and finished recently.
A lot of fun.
In our bonus series for our patrons. Last episode, we talked about Britt Marling quite a lot. And I'm sure we'll talk about it again once the last two episodes of Murder at the End of the World come out.
Last night's one was fucking amazing, Alan.
I haven't watched it yet.
All right, good.
Thank you, Dean McDonald, for artwork.
Thanks, Dave.
Cassie and Tall Tales for having us.
Love you, Cassie.
And thank you again, Megan Hyland.
Thanks, Megan.
See you soon, everybody.
Bye. Bye.